Talking about transitional tools, it is really important to take a look at why we even need transitional tools and what's going on here and where all these penalties came from, so we can get a better understanding of why we even have to have transitional tools, and then of course learn how to use the correct transitional tools for the correct thing. And as I go through this initially, I want to hone in on the amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America that created slavery. This is a new kind of slavery that got formed in America, and it had to do with getting benefits from the government. And I'm going to bring you to Article 14, Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America, and it says in Section 1, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now we have to go back and look at the basis of this constitutional amendment, because this was amendment to the Constitution that changed the black slaves of the South from being slaves to the Southern plantation owner to slaves to the United States District of Columbia jurisdiction. So now, let's, with that in mind, let's go back and take a look at it again. And you have to remember that the slaves who were not born in this country had no right to citizenship in the state or in the United States. So they passed this amendment to be able to give them a special category of citizenship, and these were just for the black slaves of the South. So once again, it's in Section 1 under Article 14. All persons born or naturalized in the United States. So now we have the United States jurisdiction. It's shown very clear here. And subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which of course is the United States District of Columbia jurisdiction, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Now here we have the state, which is a separate jurisdiction. So there's clearly a jurisdiction of the United States and a jurisdiction of the state. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction or equal protection the equal protection of the laws. So, here we have a jurisdiction of citizenship that is of the United States, the state, which is an interstate commercial, regulatory, jurisdictional authority and power. Now, let's go back to the beginning of the Constitution of the United States of America, and that's going to be on page number in the Citizens Rule Book, page number 38. We'll find the limited jurisdictional authority of the Congress. We're going to find under Article 1, Section 8 on page number 37, the Congress shall have the power. And then we go on down to that limited jurisdiction, which is on page number 38. And on that page, it's, and that's paragraph number 5. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may by session of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state, in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. So here we have the territory jurisdiction of the United States Congress, which is to make legislation only for their district and for areas that they have had ceded to them by the states for the defense of the country, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. So it's a very, very limited jurisdiction. So the question is have you been complying with legislation passed by the Congress when you have been under state jurisdiction rather than United States jurisdiction? Once again, I'm going to go over this thing. It says to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as made by session of particular states. So once again, we see the United States jurisdiction and we see the state jurisdiction. It goes on to say, in the acceptance of Congress become the seat of the government of the United States. Okay, now the United States is not the United States of America that they're talking about here. The United States is the District of Columbia and its possessions, territory ceded to it by the states for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings for the defense of the country, you see. So we have a complete separation of jurisdiction here of the United States and the state. And that's clear not only in the 14th Amendment, but it's also clear in the definition of the jurisdiction of congressional legislation. So the question is are you a United States citizen, or are you a citizen of the United States of America, or are you a citizen of the state, or are you a one world citizen? Well, if we look at that in the proper perspective, we'll see that since no matter where you go in the world, if you have a Social Security number, they want you to file returns and pay taxes, and that's because, of course, you're eligible for benefits no matter where you go in the world from that jurisdiction. Therefore, you would be a one-world citizen if you had a Social Security number. And they've already got the one-world government established, and, of course, the one-world citizenship to support it financially, which is the card-carrying communists of the USDC jurisdiction. So, now, here we want to go back to this, legislation here. That the Congress has the authority to pass, and find out where they're getting their authority from to include you in congressional legislation when you're like a citizen of the state of California, or the state of North Carolina, the state of South Carolina, the state of Texas, or whatever. And we're going to find that if you recall, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America created a brand new classification of citizenships that never existed before. They created the citizenship of the United States and the state wherein the citizens that were naturalized through the 14th Amendment, who were the black slaves of the South, they gave them a brand new citizenship status that was a dual citizenship of the state and of the United States. It never had happened before. And there was no authority of the states to interfere with the United States jurisdiction because they were slaves of the USDC jurisdiction now instead of the landowners of the South. Now, that might seem just a little bit far-fetched to some people just reading this, you know, initially, but if you analyze the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment of the Constitution very clearly, if you analyze that very, very carefully, you'll see that they created a new class of citizenship that never existed before. Number two, you'll see that the Congress has the right to regulate interstate commerce, which is on page number 37 of the Citizens Rulebook. And that says under Section 8, Clause 3, that the Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So they have an interstate commercial regulatory power between the United States and the states and between the states, which means that they brought the black slaves of the South who were slaves to the southern plantation owners under the jurisdiction of the United States District of Columbia jurisdiction as United States citizen under the Commerce Clause to regulate interstate commercial transportation, etc. So they really brought the black slaves into interstate commercial regulatory powers. And that means that we have to look for the contractual relationship, the nexus that brought other people underneath the United States District of Columbia jurisdiction, because they had no authority to regulate the citizens of the states because the states were sovereign over the United States. So we have to find out where they got that nexus of jurisdiction. So we want to look for an interstate commercial contract that's between the United States and the states whereby the people engaged in a contractual relationship that allowed the United States Congress to pass legislation which would control them. Now, let's analyze the Social Security program to see if that qualifies. Number one, you pay with Social Security with Federal Reserve notes, which is a commercial debt instrument. So it qualifies on that basis. Number two, did you enter into a contractual relationship with Social Security? Yes. As soon as you got the Social Security card, you became eligible for benefits from the United States District of Columbia jurisdiction. So if something happened to you, they'd take care of you. take care of your family, give your retirement program, a disability program, etc. And is that good between the states? Yes. Is it be good between the states and the United States? Yes. So that meets all the qualifications of an interstate commercial contract. As a matter of fact, that's an international commercial contract. Therefore, that was used to bring you into a contractual, interstate, commercial, regulatory jurisdiction with the United States so that they could govern every aspect of your life because you made yourself eligible for the benefits. And once again, I want to remind you of the Supreme Court case of Hell versus Hinkle that you owe nothing to the government as long as you receive nothing therefrom. So now, here's where the government is getting their power from to be able to control every facet of your life. Since you're eligible for benefits from them, since they have the power to regulate interstate commerce, they can pass all kinds of ridiculous rules and regulations and make people believe that they you have to comply with them. In other words, here we have the Constitution of the United States of America that's the supreme law of the land, and all the judges and all the executive officers are bound thereby to support it, you see. And then we have an interstate commercial regulatory power by the USDC jurisdiction that is claiming the authority to be able to pass any kind of a rule or regulation that they want to regulate slaves that are eligible for benefits from the government employee hireling servants. Now, that means that they've switched jurisdictions on us. That means that we used to be the master. We'd tell them what to do and pay them to do it. And the way that we used to tell them how to govern was by constitutional law. Now, what they're doing is saying, now that you're eligible for benefits from us and we're paying you, now you have to do as you're told or else we're going to take those benefits away from you. Now, that means we have to correct this by terminating the benefit-penalty relationship and not be eligible for the benefits anymore so we can put our government employees back in the box of the Constitution. And, of course, our founding fathers called it the chains of the Constitution. Now, this means also now that we have all kinds of rights here. By the way, this is brought upon us by fraud, misrepresentation. For example, the consumer fraud laws require full disclosure of contractual agreements when you're offered some kind of a contractual arrangement. And if you recall, when you went down to the Social Security Administration, they deceitfully eliminated the full disclosure of the terrible provisions of the Social Security Act. They never told you that there was no actuarially sound funds being invested. They never told you that this was an insurance program. They never told you it was a Ponzi scheme. They didn't tell you that as soon as you got that Social Security card that authorized the employer to be able to take funds out of your pay for income tax and Social Security tax, they did not tell you that it changed your jurisdictional nexus from that of being a sovereign citizen over the government to a slave underneath the government. So there was no full disclosure here. That's an absolute total violation of the consumer fraud laws. And Social Security is an insurance program. They're not licensed to do business in any state with this insurance program. And Ponzi schemes are illegal in, I think I almost go so far as to say, so almost every state of the union, they're illegal. So they're operating an illegal insurance Ponzi scheme contract that is in violation of the consumer fraud laws. Now, since all this was brought upon us by fraud and misrepresentation, you have the right to revoke all these contractual arrangements based on that fraud, terminate everything attached to the Social Security number, as we've already discussed. And when you do this, when you pull away from that jurisdiction, you regain your sovereignty. Now, that means you have to close down everything associated with the number. You can't have one thing standing where you're benefited from that jurisdiction. Now, that means that you have regained your sovereign rights. You're not a slave of that jurisdiction any longer. Now you have a right to go ahead and reorganize your life to be totally free from that jurisdiction. Now, when we're doing that, that means we have a right to identify ourselves in any way we want. And some people have a problem with this and some people don't, but I just want you to know that the biblical principles are that God changed the names of his prophets numerous times. And I think he did that because he was changing the character of his prophets and therefore giving him a new name to go along with that new character. And that was not reported to the government. They just had the right to change the names. I want everybody to know that you have a right to change your name. There's nothing criminal or illegal about that. Incidentally, there's no constitutional authority given to government employees to determine what we should call or not call ourselves. There's no constitutional authority for them to register a birth certificate in their jurisdiction over our children. There's no authority in the Constitution for them to license us in the Constitution for any endeavor. They simply do not have those authorities. So when you decide that you want to reorganize your life, transitional tools are very, very helpful in being able to reorganize your business affairs and your personal affairs to be totally free of their jurisdiction, because they're going to try real hard to keep you scared and fearful and wanting to be their slave. And there's going to be some incredible challenges that you might go through if you wanted to transition out. Now, I'm not telling people that they should or shouldn't do this. I just want everybody to know that they have the choice. They have the choice to be a slave in their in that jurisdiction, and they have a right to be free and be a master over the government. I think it's extremely important that we take up the challenge to be free, and if we don't, we're going to find that our government employee hirelings, unless they're corrected, are going to continue to create inflation and destroy our economy. Now, some of this might be a little bit of a review, but I want to go through this in a little bit more detail, so it's good to repeat it, to permeate it in our minds, and to find out what it is we can do to kind of change our direction. And I want you to know this is really important, because I have had people calling me, telling me that they had rescinded the Social Security number years and years ago, and it didn't work. And then in questioning those individuals, I find out that they kept on using the Social Security number after they had claimed to have rescinded it. It's like saying, I'm not going to eat the banana, you go ahead and eat the banana anyway. You know, you just can't compromise on these issues. If you're going to make a change to be free, you have to give up the Social Security number for everything. You have no choice. You can't use it for a thing. I don't care what the circumstance is. If you want to be free, you cannot use that number. If you're going to use that number, you're going to be a slave. Just as simple as that. And by the way, they're going to control you and have access to everything you have. And you'll have the choice, you know, to be a slave or be free. If you decide to, you know, be a slave, that's fine. You know, the Bible even says if you're going to be a slave, be a good one. So what we want to do is decide that if you're going to be a slave, to maximize your benefit from the system and minimize your penalties. And if you're going to be free, we're going to maximize your benefits and minimize your penalties as well. So as we're making this transition, what we want to do is eliminate all confrontations with the government. I've already told you that I went into a very confrontational situation with them, and I'm aware of the fact a lot of people are not interested in doing that. So what we want to do is we want to go through a non-confrontational change with them. And at the same time, we want to learn how to utilize transitional tools, not only to get ourselves free, but also to utilize in marketing to other people in free enterprise, so we can switch out of being working as an employee for an employer, having deductions out of our paycheck, to working for ourselves in association with other people and getting a full paycheck. No deductions from the paycheck. So, number one, we're going to just start listing some of the typical products we have that we can utilize for those purposes. And we're going to do the democracy versus republic chart again. We're going to draw a line down the center of a piece of paper that is laid out long ways. And we're going to put democracy on the left, republic on the right. And under the republican form of government, this write down pure common law trust. Now, on the pure common law trust, what I want to say about that is just simply that pure just simply means that it is not mixed in with other things. We're going to keep it purely in the common law, no statutory provisions whatsoever, and absolutely no registration with the United States District of Columbia jurisdiction, meaning that we're not going to get a taxpayer's identification number for it. So that's one of our transitional tools, and I'll show you how to use that. Number two, after pure common law trust, on the Republican side, we're also going to put down offshore foreign, F-O-R-E-I-G-N, trust. Offshore foreign trust. Now, this offshore foreign trust is going to have a trustee in a foreign jurisdiction out of this country, whereas the pure common law trust can have anyone to be the trustee. But the offshore foreign trust has to have a trustee in a foreign country. Then we're going to go on to list, in the democracy, we'll list domestic trust. And the domestic trust is utilized to own properties in the democracy. We're going to call it a domestic trust because it's domestic to the USDC jurisdiction, because it applies to the IRS and gets a tax identification number. So you might want to write down domestic trust on the left, applies for and receives a tax identification number. We also have, in the democracy side, we would have a partnership. So partnerships can be utilized. They get apply for and receive a tax identification number. Then they can be utilized to reorganize your affairs into a partnership. Have the partnership own assets. Have the partnership receive the income. And the reason for that is, number one, partnerships pay no tax. And next, the government cannot lien a partnership for one of the partner's tax liabilities, so you might want to just say, go ahead and say no liening. So if you had a situation where you had moved everything in the partnership, you didn't own it anymore, nothing in your name, and you decided to make a transition, and you did something wrong, you made some kind of a mistake, the IRS thought you owed something that you didn't owe, and they wanted to try to lien, levy, and seize properties. If you didn't have anything, they couldn't lien you, and they could not lien the partnership assets for your tax liability. Then we also have, on the left-hand side, we have under partnership list limited liability company. And a limited liability company is a lot like a partnership, except it costs more to form, typically speaking. And number two, it's limited to the assets of that company, whereas in a partnership, there could be liabilities that would extend to the partners after the partnership pays all bills. Now, if the partners of the partnership had everything in trust, nothing in their name, then of course the liability would stop at the partnership assets. It would not go beyond that. So we can utilize limited liability companies as well as transitional tools. Then we also have international business corporations. And international business corporations can be domestic to the democracy, and they can be foreign to the democracy in a foreign country. But I'm going to put them on the democracy side just for one reason. IBCs are corporations, international business corporations. They are under a government, even if it's a foreign government. So they're underneath the government. And that's what I like about trust. We can write trust in our jurisdiction. You have to remember, we have a jurisdiction. Our jurisdiction is everything we didn't give to the government. We did not give the government any power or authority to control our right of contract, and trusts are our right of contract. Therefore, we have a right to go into trust and conduct all of our affairs, in free enterprise affairs, through those trust organizations, not making the government and a third party to those contractual arrangements. Therefore, since the trusts are not benefited slave organizations, they would not owe anything to the government. Now, what I'm talking about here is I'm talking about combinations or singularly domestic trusts, partnerships, limited liability companies, international business corporations, pure common law trust organizations, and offshore trusts as transitional tools that make for a wonderful networking project to help other people reorganize their free enterprise, I should say, correction, their business affairs into free enterprise. And we can do that with a substantial portion of the earnings, and sometimes with 100%. In any event, people are going to find out that they're going to be able to reduce their taxes, they're going to be able to get more freedom, they're going to be able to put properties away in organizations that are not taxable entities or don't have a tax liability, so there's no liening, levying, and seizing and selling property. So let's just stop and think about what we're talking about here. If you have an interest in networking, you know, products in a free enterprise, there's none better than this. You're able to help people by reducing their taxes, and the reduction of the taxes, you're going to be able to earn enough to pay your way. In other words, there's no real, there's some upfront expenses, from a client, you know, to pay for these organizations, for this reorganization process. But most of these expenses can be paid off by far earlier than even a year. Pay for the whole cost of the reorganization. So just think about having a free enterprise opportunity where there's no Social Security number involved, there's no taxpayer's identification number involved, there's no filing, paying, and reporting. You're just dealing with other wonderful people, and you're being able to offer them a service that pays for itself within a year and gives them some kind of an insulation protection from the system, or maybe a total reorganization of their lives where they don't have to associate in the system anymore with a number. What kind of a price tag can you put on that kind of a service? It's just an invaluable service. It's fun. It's productive. It's beneficial. It's useful. And it helps the economy. You see, what happens is when we take the funds away from the system, who is wastefully spending these funds on irresponsible projects, like, for example, a study of the sex habits of bugs, or to invade other countries, or to carry out a massive murder of unborn babies through federally funded abortion clinics. When they're doing those things, you see, they're wasting your funds for destructive purposes. What we need to do is rechannel our revenues and utilize those for productive purposes. Now, the question is what's going to happen if all of us do this and all of us stop paying these taxes? Is the country going to fall apart? Are the roads going to cease being built? No. You pay for the roads with the gas tax. And we pay more in gas taxes now than what they pay to build the roads. So the roads are not going to get hurt. As a matter of fact, we'll be able to build more roads, because when people stop paying all these ludicrous taxes, we're going to have more funds to spend. If we have more funds to spend, we're going to buy more gas. If we buy more gas, we'll have more tax revenues to build better roads. So we'll actually wind up with better roads, not worse roads. Okay, how about the schools? Are the school systems going to collapse? Well, the federal government only contributes funds that they get from us in the first place. Just stop and think about it. You stop up and think about these federal sharing programs where they pay money to the states for their educational purposes. The question is where do they get those funds from? They got them from we the people in the states. So they take them away from us, you see, and then they want to bribe us by offering them back if we reorganize our educational programs to suit them, according to their will, according to their whim. Okay, so all we have to do is stop giving them those taxes in the first place, keep those funds here, don't pay the federal government to get involved with it, go back to reorganizing our schools, back to basic principles of education, put God's law back in there with the Ten Commandments, give our kids a moral foundation to live by, we'll improve our schools, improve our kids, and we'll all get along a lot better. Now, I don't care what your religious belief is. If you just read the Ten Commandments, you'll see there's a lot of good principles that if we were to follow, that we could live more harmoniously together. I want to get just a little bit more specific now with these trusts and what we're going to do with them. The absolute best use for a pure common law trust, number one, would be to engage it in free enterprise activities. We're not going to do business anymore. Now what we're going to do is contract with each other. We're going to sell services. We're going to sell it through the trust. The trust is going to earn the funds. The trust is going to pay the bills. It's going to buy properties, and we're going to use the properties. So pure common law trusts are great for free enterprise activities. No more businesses. No tax identification numbers. No filing, no paying, no reporting. It's foreign to the USDC jurisdiction, and you can utilize an Internal Revenue Service form WA to establish a foreign exempt account with that pure common law trust, so that the bank is exempted from reporting to the Internal Revenue Service on any earnings by that pure common law trust. So the pure common law trust, remembering that it is not a benefit of the slave of the state, it doesn't receive benefits, it's not required to pay anything to them. And next we can use a pure common law trust for holding properties. Remember, you don't have to get a tax ID number for it. You can acquire properties with it. You would not want to exchange properties into it if you're going to be the trustee. And I want to make this perfectly clear about trust. You have to be really careful in how to utilize trust. And by the way, we have a lot of expert advice to help people with that and to guide them to prevent making mistakes, because there's a lot of promoters of trust going around that want to sell a trust to you whereby you put properties into the trust and then they make you the trustee. That's called an illusory trust. It's an illusion that it's a trust because you're not trusting anyone. So number one, the definition of trust has to be that you're trusting someone else. So write down the word trust as a definition of a trust. You have to be trusting someone else with the property. Now, a pure common law foreign trust would be capitalized. In other words, a trustor who's putting the money into the trust would be someone other than the trustee who is appointed. So if you're going to want to be the trustee and be controlling the trust, then someone else has to put the money into capitalizing. And if you're going to be the trustor, put the money into the trust, then you have to have someone else to be the trustee. Otherwise, it's not a completed trust. Now, a lot of people are always complaining about, well, I'm afraid to let somebody else have control of my property because I'm afraid they're going to run off with my property. And if you just consider the fact that you've given trusteeship of all the properties you've ever accumulated in your life over to the USDC jurisdiction so they can take it away from you anytime they want, you'll see that you've already done what you maybe don't like doing. But if you're careful in the selection of the trustee, you're not going to have any difficulty or little to no difficulty. What the worst thing that you can do is to put properties that you want to protect later on into an individual's name, because individuals do die and can cause you a lot of problems. But organizations do not die. They go on forever. Officers just change, but the organization itself lives forever. So you would want to utilize the pure common law trust for those two things, for free enterprise activities, and then again, after free enterprise activities, to hold properties with that trust that you did not want to get a federal tax identification number for. Okay, now we have the offshore foreign trust. The offshore foreign trust can be utilized to, number one, invest in free enterprise activities. That's passive investments, free enterprise, tax-free, no filing, no paying, no reporting. Once again, using the W-8 exempt number to get an exempt foreign account that the bank would not be required to report on to the USDC jurisdiction, number one. Number two, you could utilize that for all kinds of passive investments. You can utilize it for stocks and bonds and mutual funds, any kind of investments in the stock market and real estate, loaning funds, all kinds of passive investments. Then again, free enterprise. Free enterprise means any kind of an activity where there's a contractual relationship involved by two parties. In other words, you would not get a tax identification number for it from the USDC jurisdiction. Therefore, it would not be a benefited slave. It would not have to report any of its earnings to that jurisdiction since it would not be a member of that jurisdiction. Okay, then on to domestic trusts. On the left-hand side of the democracy, we want to define that as a trust that we would utilize in the system, getting a tax identification number to hold properties. And we want to do that, number one, to protect the properties down the road, not maybe sometimes always immediately, but down the road from liens, levies, and seizures. If you got in an accident and somebody was to sue you, you wouldn't want them to get all the properties you've accumulated in your entire life, so you would want that in another trust. And if later on in your life you decide you want to become a tax protester, not file returns, not pay taxes, and the IRS concocted a lien against you, well, then you would not want them to be able to take the properties. So therefore, you could utilize the domestic trust for that purpose. Next, the partnership is an absolutely wonderful tool for exchanging properties into, especially when it's specially prepared and formulated to be financed by a domestic trust that is financed by a foreign trust that's financed by another foreign trust in a foreign country. And the reason for that is you can set up the trust to where the investment party, which is the domestic trust tied to foreign trust, owns up to 95% of the company, and you only own 5%. That means 5% would be given to you as income when the return is filed, and the 95% would flow out to foreign beneficiaries tax-free. No filing, no pay, no reporting, no income tax, no Social Security tax on the 95% that goes out. So if you're talking about someone now who is in business paying 100%, I should say the revenues they're receiving would be subject to tax, 100% of it would be subject to tax. We could switch that so only 95% would be subject to tax and 95% would flow out to foreign beneficiaries. Then a limited liability company works in the same method as a partnership. It's going to be tied to a domestic investment trust and also a foreign trust, another foreign trust, so that when it files, it also would pay no tax, and up to 95% of it can be flowed out to foreign beneficiaries, meaning it would be tax-free. That means the Social Security tax is absolutely gone on that 95%. The income tax is gone on that 95%. Now, there are some administrative charges to run some organizations like that. There are some expenses to it, but in relationship to the taxes, they're very, very small. A big upside of having a partnership or having a limited liability company is you have that opportunity to reorganize your assets, so it reduces your so-called income substantially, such that not only are your taxes reduced, but you fall into a much lower tax group. You're much less visible, you know, for tax purposes. Not only that, but you could reorganize your affairs to the point where you wouldn't be associated with it anymore, just be able to control it through investment techniques. And maybe reorganize your entire life so that you would not have to use a Social Security number ever again for anything. You just have to have someone interface with those organizations to look after your interests, and you can control it from an investment point of view. Now, the International Business Corporation is being touted by a lot of people, and it's just another corporation underneath another government. It's not a big deal. Corporations have been around a long time. They've just put an international business in front of corporation. It's the same kind of an entity. It's no big deal. That's been around forever with the corporations that sprang up and became so popular after 1909. It's nothing to brag about or anything, but we have those available as well. It's just that I've never found anything that an international business corporation could do that a trust could not do, except in certain jurisdictions where they're not too thrilled about trust. Now, in America, trusts are no problem. In most countries of the world, trusts are no problem. But if you go into an area like the Bahamas, it might be better to have an international business corporation. You will find that international business corporations are more expensive to obtain, more expensive to keep up. But they can be utilized in pretty much the same way. You just utilize it with a W-8 foreign exempt account in the States and open up that foreign account and then go about doing free enterprise and passive investments. Now, what you'll find is a lot of people are going to be, even after you get these organizations, a lot of people are not aware of these two different jurisdictions, the democracy and the republic, and they're always telling people you still have to get these tax ID numbers and put these things under the system. It just simply is not true. Tax identification numbers are totally voluntary, just like Social Security numbers. So I think I've given you enough information about some of these organizations that you can utilize. Not only that, but you can network to other people and learn how to reorganize their businesses. There's professional backup support. You're in association with people that have done this a very, very long period of time. We have a long track record of having established foreign connections and foreign banking relationships, foreign tax haven jurisdictions, and also in international transfers of funds to be able to make all these business connections work, and of course foreign and domestic investments. And we have some good investment programs that we're going to go into more detail later in the tape, but I just want you to know that as far as investments are concerned, I want everybody to consider that there's no better investment than into free enterprise. It's free enterprise that made this country great. Free enterprise is springing up all over the country now, so let's work together to do some free enterprise investments that we'll get a good return in. And I'm familiar with investments that I have involved myself in that get anywhere from 100 to 200% return per year gross. And the net's not always going to be that much because there's expenses that have to be paid out for cost of investing the funds. But there are good investments available that do get a very, very good return. And it does help the country when we invest in free enterprise projects, because those are projects that we're going to do without Social Security numbers, no taxpayers' ID numbers, no filing, no paying reporting. We're going to do them through foreign organizations. And if you have an interest in that, fine, just contact the people from who you got these tapes, and we'll be able to get in touch and chat about these in future communications. And as far as the details on these types of transitional tools, I just want you to know that the whole purpose of this is to reorganize your affairs, to help you to very, very quickly, or as soon as you're ready to do this, to be able to get properties into trust organizations so you can get break free from the jurisdictional connection that the USDC jurisdiction has over your person, so you can become as free as you want to become. And no one's trying to tell you through these tapes how free you should be. That's your choice. We just want to help you to become as free as you can possibly be. God bless you. Best wishes. Keith Anderson.